If not, their family members should let them know and tell them, because I think it will prevent a lot of future divorces if they understand how the woman is.
We'll be back after a short while. Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir. In the time of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, there was a man who came to Prophet and told him, like, whenever I go to home, my wife tells me, oh, why are you depressed? Why are you stressed? If you are stressed for this world, I wish that your stress should increase for that world. If it's for that world here, if it's for the hereafter, I wish an increase in your stress. But if it's for this world, I want you to like change it. Like, I wish your stress get reduced. And Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, says that this woman is definitely from the havens that you have been blessed with. So conversations are very important. Understanding each other is very important. You said me versus you should be discouraged, and me with you should actually be the thing that should be encouraged. And we also have towards the end of the Dua Kamal that his name is the medicine, and his zikr, reciting his name again, is the shifa, the medicine and cure from every depression, every kind of feeling lowness, is his name, reciting his name, and it really helps. It's really, really something that gives you peace. Thank you so much, guys, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, ya Rabbal Alameen, ya Rahman, ya Rahim, ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Ya Allah, ya Rabbal Alameen, ya Rahman, ya Rahim, ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The spokesman of the Yemeni army, Yahya Sariya, says the country's air defenses shot down a spy drone operated by Saudi Arabia with a locally made surface-to-air missile. Sariya says the aircraft was carrying out hostile acts in Yemeni airspace in violation of the UN brokered truce, which came into effect on April 2nd and expires in days.
A combat drone belonging to the Saudi-led coalition that was flying over Sana'a was shot down and fell here on the Ruwaishan crossroad. The Saudi-led coalition continues to violate the truce, and unfortunately the United Nations has not taken any action to protect the truce that it sponsors.
Local media say three civilians were killed and three others were wounded after the drone crashed in a residential area in Sana'a. In the wake of the incident, head of Yemen's negotiating delegation Mohammed Abdus Salam says the Saudi-led coalition is responsible for a possible breakdown of the peace process. The negotiating team says the UN should hold the coalition to account for its actions.
In the face of all these violations and delays in implementing the terms of the armistice, the United Nations must hold the obstructing party that violates the terms of the armistice fully responsible. The United Nations cannot impose specific sanctions on any of the parties, but it can at least condemn the violations. Therefore, the United Nations must take a positive attitude and condemn any party that violates the armistice that it sponsors.
The two-month truce mandates a nationwide ceasefire. Under the agreement, the coalition must also allow fuel ships to enter the port city of Hudaydah. However, the Saudi-led coalition has repeatedly ignored its obligations. The new violation of the UN brokered truce once more demonstrates how Saudi Arabia is blocking a political solution in Yemen by its repeated breaches. People here demand that the United Nations take action and adopt a clear stance against the infringements by the Saudi-led coalition. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Rights groups warn that people are dying from lack of medicines in Afghanistan. Afghan Medicine Services Union also says that medicine supplies in the country are running low and that no medicine might be available to the patients within the next 2 months.
Afghanistan is facing an unprecedented drug shortage and a sharp rise in drug prices. These days we are supplying drugs from our stocks and reserves, and I'm afraid they will run out of medicines within the next 2 months. This situation has hit our nation, health sector, and drug sellers.
The union blames the banking crisis, major cuts in global aid, and U.S. sanctions for the medicine shortage. It also called on the Taliban to allow traders to import medicine in any possible way.
Medicine shortage is rooted in different problems. Firstly, most world countries have stopped medicine export to Afghanistan since the Islamic Emirate is not recognized worldwide. Secondly, major amounts of drug importers' money is freezed and banks in New York are not cooperating. Thirdly, the Taliban have imposed certain restrictions on drug imports.
Patients in Wazir Akbar Khan Hospital in Kabul complain about their inability to provide medicines, calling for help from the international community to save their lives.
I am from the Jawzjan province. I have brought my child for treatment in this hospital in Kabul. I have been here for 5 days and I spent all my money on services and medications. Some medicines are very hard to find and some very expensive. The doctor has given me this prescription and I am wondering how to provide the drugs.
This comes as Afghanistan is facing multiple outbreaks of diseases, including COVID-19, measles, and acute malnutrition. Afghan hospitals and clinics are running out of medicines. Doctors here say urgent action is needed to save the lives of patients. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Donetsk, the capital of the Donbass People's Republic, on a sleepy Sunday morning. The front line is only 6 kilometers away. The occasional boom of artillery or anti-air defense can be heard.
People think it's normal in the DPR, but we have no more patience to wait until it ends, to live under bombing. All my relatives and I are sometimes under shelling. Once a shell flew over my head and killed a woman nearby. It's possible to live here. I was born here, and I suppose I will die here too.
Most of the people on the streets are women. Since Russia entered the conflict, conscription was introduced here, and while the DPR militias have majority support, I've heard of some men who stay in their park 24/7 so as not to be forced to join.
Now, to my knowledge, there are no English-speaking mainstream journalists here in Russian-held Ukraine. I think there's a French, a German, an Italian, but that's about it. So, in terms of journalists from NATO countries, there's almost none. And the problem with that is that people living in NATO countries simply don't hear the views of people here in Donetsk.
The first thing I would like to say is that the DPR exists because we are free people. We want our own opinions, our own independence and our own views of the world, not the viewpoint that someone imposes on us. So we are defending our interests. That's why the DPR exists.
The majority of people here are Russian speakers with a proud Russian culture. A bust of Pushkin, the famous Russian poet, stands outside the drama theatre. And in the main square, Lenin.
In 2014, I was in Kiev covering the Ukrainian revolution, or coup, whatever you want to call it, where I witnessed the pulling down of a statue of Lenin by Ukrainian nationalists. Now, if the Donetsk People's Republic didn't exert control in this area, this statue here most probably would have been pulled down by Ukrainian nationalists as well. And it's statues like this, statues like this that are important to people's culture here.
Since the nationalistic Ukrainian government took power in Kiev in 2014, they have attempted to impose their agenda on the majority Russian areas, pulling down statues and forcing institutions to drop Russian as an official language. There has also been the killing of dozens of pro-Russian activists. This is what led to Donbass rising up and attempting to create a breakaway state.
Certainly the rights of the Russian-speaking population were stomped on. There were demands that we should speak Ukrainian and not Russian, and all administration procedures were changed to Ukrainian. I think that any culture should be looked after and passed on to young people. It's very important because young people cannot grow up without their culture. There cannot be any people without their culture.
Of course I was born here. This is my land. I studied here at the Institute. We studied both Russian and Ukrainian. It was normal. And when they started to kill us, we couldn't understand how it could happen. How people can treat their compatriots like this. We are constantly being killed from morning to night here.
The flags of Donbass and Russia side by side. While at first demanding autonomy, since the war they are adamant they want to be independent or to join Russia. President Zelensky recently said that negotiations are the only way to end this conflict. If lasting peace is to be made, the rights, culture and wishes of the 4 million people here in Donbass need to be taken into account. Chernomyl Donetsk.
The petrochemical complex of Augusta Priolo is a vast industrialized coastal area in eastern Sicily, which includes one of Europe's largest oil refineries, the ISAB plant. This refinery processes about 14% of Italy's crude, about 10.6 million tons a year, and exports in dozens of countries around the world. Owned by the Moscow-based company Lukoil, the ISAB refinery has been forced to rethink its supply strategy as the EU is aiming to get rid of its dependence on Russian energy following the conflict in Ukraine. Since lenders and oil companies have stopped providing financing and crude to Lukoil after Brussels imposed sanctions on the Kremlin, the ISAB refinery is only left to rely on supplies from Russia.
Although Lukoil is not under sanctions, banks and insurance companies prefer not to work with Russian ones. Lukoil can only process Russian crude. That's why, in order to keep the company running, the import of crude oil has increased significantly in Italy.
Moscow has exported about 450,000 barrels per day of crude to Italy in May, more than four times as much as it did before the start of the conflict in Ukraine, and the most since 2013. Rome may soon become the EU's largest Russian crude importer, this despite Brussels urging all members of the bloc to cut ties to Russian energy. Some unions and think tanks have warned that a total Russian oil embargo would have the immediate effect of shutting down not only the ISAB refinery, but also other large petrochemical plants and many smaller companies in the area. Energy analysts have noted that Russian crude exports have also increased to the port of Trieste near Italy's northeastern border with Slovenia, where the oil is delivered through the Transalpine pipeline to two other Russian-owned refineries in Germany. Max Civili, Rome.
Hundreds of Palestinians attended a national conference in the blockaded Gaza Strip to mark the first anniversary of the victory of Palestinian resistance against the Israeli regime in the Sword of Al-Quds battle. The Gaza-based resistance groups, mainly Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, fired more than 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war. The Sword of Al-Quds battle began when Hamas's Izzeddin Qassam brigades attacked the Israeli regime in retaliation to Israeli aggressions on Palestinians in Al-Quds Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. During the battle, Israeli attacks claimed the lives of over 260 Palestinians, including scores of children and women. Addressing the conference via satellite, the head of the political bureau of Hamas movement, Ismail Haniyeh, warned the Israeli regime against holding the so-called flag march in Al-Quds.
The Zionist enemy must understand that the Sword of Al-Quds battle will be a walk in the park compared to any future battles with Palestinian resistance groups. The Zionists must not test our patience, and they must stop their provocations, especially in Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians believe that the Sword of Al-Quds battle has united their ranks. During the 11-day war, all Palestinian factions in the Gaza Strip worked together through the Joint Chamber of Military Operations.
During the Sword of Al-Quds battle, Palestinians were united together against the Israeli forces. The Sword of Al-Quds battle exposed the weakness of the Israeli regime. The Palestinian people in Gaza, in Al-Quds, and in the occupied West Bank will always fight for their rights.
Palestinian resistance groups have been holding military maneuvers following the Sword of Al-Quds battle to confront any new Israeli war amid the increasing warmongering rhetoric by the Israeli regime.
Observers say that Palestinian resistance groups fought a fierce battle against the Israeli regime last year, forcing Tel Aviv to declare a unilateral ceasefire. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
French cement giant Lafarge has lost their final appeal and will undergo a high-profile trial in a precedent-setting case which could force Western corporations to stop turning a blind eye to terrorism. Lafarge will be tried for complicity in crimes against humanity in Syria. They are accused of working with Daesh terrorist group for years in northern Syria, with the concrete produced in their factory used in battlefield infrastructure, which terrorists needed to keep the unrest going. They will be tried for financing terrorism, for allegedly paying 13 million euros to terrorist groups from 2010 to 2014, supposedly to keep their factories safe. They will also be charged for endangering the lives of others, for putting its 11 Syrian employees at risk. The original suit was brought by French NGO Sherpa on behalf of the workers.
We were surprised by the decision of the Court de Cassation, and this decision is really a victory because we were a bit worried that crimes against humanity would be dropped. But the fact also that on top of that, there is endangering life of workers that has been maintained is really, I mean, a double victory. So we are super happy, even though we have to remember that it's been 6 years.
After the scandal broke, Lafarge was merged with Swiss giant Holcim, but 8 Lafarge executives will now face justice.
It's the first time that a court decided on crimes against humanity, the first time it's on the mother company for the activities of its subsidiary, especially a subsidiary abroad and foreign workers. It's super interesting for access to justice for victims around the globe. And maybe opening, you know, new avenues for the victims of globalization around the world.
Leaked testimony from the Lafarge executives reveals that the French Foreign Ministry knew the entire time, telling Lafarge to hold on and that everything would work out. The case will likely drag on for years, but longtime political heavyweight and former foreign minister Laurent Fabius may be called on to testify. In 2012, he infamously said that al-Nusra, al-Qaeda's affiliate in Syria, was, quote, doing good things on the ground and likely with Lafarge's concrete. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
The drama theater of Mariupol. It is the scene of the alleged single most deadly war crime so far in this brutal conflict. Depending on who you believe, it was either a Russian airstrike or done by the Ukrainians to blame it on Russia. The words children are still scrawled on the pavement outside, written in order to ward off a Russian strike.
I talked to emergency workers a week ago. Our fire brigade is over there, and they told me they found 2 more dead bodies.
He breaks down and walks away, unnecessarily ashamed of his tears.
I lost everything. What is left for me here? I have worked here all my life.
This is the second time that I've been here in the last few days. Since the last time, there's a little bit more rubble being cleared up. Interestingly, you can just walk straight in, even though it's a crime scene or a former crime scene, and still a site where it's still pretty dangerous in places. But you can walk straight in, it's that easy. But finding out just what happened here is a little harder. At the very least, I wanted to find out just how many people had died here. Estimates range from around 30 to over 600. A workman took me down to the basement, but told me his team had only recovered 3 bodies from the rubble. He also grumbled that they could have worked much faster if they hadn't been ordered to remove brick by brick due to, as he called them, fake stories about hundreds underneath. Some eyewitnesses and previous media reports say that there were over 100 outside the theatre at a field kitchen. None survived, they said. This is Alexander. He says he was sheltering in a basement nearby and came to the theater the morning after the explosion.
We thought there would be between 500 to 1,000 dead. There are three floors, but only 20 bodies were dug out, which means the others were led out from the theater. Outside, beside the kitchen, there were 15 bodies, thank God.
Witnesses say there was 100 people outside at a food shelter, and they were all killed. Is that what you saw?
No, they only found 20 inside the basement and 15 outside. That's all. We thought that there were 1,000 dead, and we were going around these ruins shouting if there was anyone alive still. There were arms and legs. It's difficult to put it into words.
Alexander also finds it hard to hold back the tears. If this was a Russian strike, it would still constitute a war crime. But have the figures been exaggerated to cause greater uproar?
There is a famous Russian journalist and TV personality. I've spoken to them. They are unsurprisingly very clear that this was a Ukrainian strike to blame on the Russians. But there isn't just a battle on the ground here in Ukraine. There's also a propaganda war as Russia seeks to justify its invasion, and NATO and Ukraine seek to make Russia out to be committing heinous war crimes.
At the nearest hospital, I speak to a medic who was working at the time of the explosion.
Maybe it was a strike from the air. According to another account, it was mined and detonated. I cannot say for sure. It's not clear.
Why couldn't you get to the theater as an ambulance driver?
At that time, the Russian military didn't let us go to the theater. There were battles going on nearby.
If Alexander's testimony is to be believed, and if the workmen are correct about there being few bodies in the rubble, then did the Russians take away hundreds of bodies in the hours after the explosion, in which they took control of the area and before the morning? Possibly. In an honest world, an independent investigation would be carried out to find out what happened and how many people died. But for now, as the war continues to rage, that seems unlikely. As they say, history is written by the winners. Johnny Miller, Mariupol.
The UK, home to some of the richest people on the planet. The capital, London, alone, has more billionaires than any other city in the world. That's all according to UK Daily, the Sunday Times Rich List. In this country, it says 250 people now own a combined $886 billion, enough to lift millions out of extreme poverty several times over.
It clearly shows that the capitalist system is not working, and obviously we are celebrating that there are so many more millionaires who have more than doubled or tripled their wealth in the last 2 years, while the poor have become really even poorer.
Many of the names on the list have been there for years. This year, though, two new faces. Chancellor Rishi Sunak, the man in charge of helping millions of struggling British families through the spiraling cost of living crisis, and his wife.
Evidently, someone of his wealth has no understanding of the crisis that a majority of the people are facing. We have 4 million people going to food banks, and the crisis, the cost of living crisis, is becoming very significant. By the end of the year, the ordinary people, the poorer sections of the community, may be even in more difficulty, while Mr. Rishi Sunak is laughing all the way to the bank.
The bulk of Rishi Sunak's wealth stems from his wife, the daughter of an Indian IT mogul. He also made his fortune working for Goldman Sachs and as a hedge fund manager in the past. We wanted to know how Britons felt about their chancellor now being one of the 250 wealthiest people in the country amidst the cost of living crisis that's pushing millions of people into poverty.
I believe it's not fair, particularly the way we found out suddenly. Out of the blue.
I don't feel particular resentment at people who have money, as long as they do their job and do their job well. No one would have known had not it been highlighted recently.
First published in 1989, the Sunday Times Rich List bears the names of 1,000 ultra-rich people or families resident in the United Kingdom. 90% of those on the list are usually men.
At a time of record inflation, when many are struggling with energy bills, petrol prices and food costs, this golden era for the UK's super rich, among them now a government official, does not seem to be coming to an end. Saeed Poor is up, London.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
مال حرام، لقمه های حرام، حقوق ها و درآمد های حرام از دست شیطان گرفته میشه.
Haram or illegitimate property, money, salary and income are all given by the Satan to the people. On the other hand, halal or legitimate income and earnings are given to good people through Allah's angels, especially Mikael, and then the Ahlul Bayt, who are the medium for reaching the blessings of Allah. Halal income creates a type of positive tendency in the people towards goodness. Haram income is exactly the opposite. You may take your salary or wage from the hands of a corrupted trader, but in fact, you are taking it from the hands of the Satan himself.
مال حرام فیض نیست که واسطش اهل بیت باشن.
Haram income and property is not a type of blessing which is given through legitimate and pure personalities like Ahlul Bayt. Thus, if haram income enters the life of a person, his life will be dark and doom. Haram or illegitimate income discourages a person into spirituality and light of heart. Gradually, the heart and soul of such a person is filled with cruelty and oppression. Then the corrupted person becomes weak in his beliefs, and even he or she may be blasphemous. This is how the Satan and satanic powers trap the believers. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The super rich have rigged the system with impunity for decades and they are now reaping the benefits, says Oxfam International Executive Director. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by John Cooley, journalist. This article is published under the heading Tax Billionaire Wealth and Pandemic Profits, says Oxfam, to end inequality that literally kills. Here's more. In the shadow of the Davos Summit of Global Elites taking place, a new report from Oxfam International details how skyrocketing inequality during 2 years of the global COVID-19 pandemic surged to a point where a new billionaire was created in the world nearly every day, while over 1 million people are now being pushed into poverty at almost the same daily rate. The new report, titled Profiting from Pain, is the latest accounting of how the pandemic has only deepened grotesque discrepancies between the haves and have-nots of the world. showing that while 573 new billionaires were created since the pandemic began, approximately 1 billionaire every 30 hours, an estimated 263 million are expected to crash into extreme poverty this year, a rate of 1 million people every 33 hours. Such a stark realities and gross injustice around the world, the anti-poverty group concludes, is clearly evidence that a tax on billionaire wealth and windfall pandemic profits is urgently needed to address crucial needs. Billionaires are arriving in Davos to celebrate an incredible surge in their fortunes. The pandemic and now the steep increases in food and energy prices have simply put been a bonanza for them. Meanwhile, decades of progress on extreme poverty are now in reverse, and millions of people are facing impossible rises in the cost of simply staying alive, said Gabriela Butcher, executive director of Oxfam International. Among the key findings of the report, today, 2,668 billionaires, 573 more than in 2020, own $12.7 trillion, an increase of $3.78 trillion. The world's 10 richest men own more wealth than the bottom 40% of humanity, 3.1 billion people. The richest 20 billionaires are worth more than the entire GDP of sub-Saharan Africa. A worker in the bottom 50% would have to work for 112 years to earn what a person in the top 1% gets in a single year. And high informality and overload due to care tasks have kept 4 million women in Latin America and the Caribbean out of the workforce. Half of working women of color in the U.S. earn less than $15 an hour. While a tall stack of reports have documented such trends since the pandemic took hold in early 2020, Oxfam's latest study shines a bright light on the massive profits in the key sectors of energy, food, and pharmaceutical companies, all of which are able to consolidate financial gains due to their monopoly control over commodities essential to society. According to Butcher, the fortunes of the world's billionaires have not increased because they are now smarter or working harder than the average worker. Many who faced layoffs, lack of hours, fractured families, childcare crises, and dangerous work conditions throughout the pandemic. She said the super rich have rigged the system with impunity for decades and they're now reaping the benefits. They have seized a shocking amount of the world's wealth as a result of privatization and monopolies, gutting regulation and work rights, while stashing their cash in tax havens, all with the complicity of governments. At the same time, she added, hundreds of millions of regular workers and their families are skipping meals, turning off the heating, falling behind on bills, and wondering what they can possibly do next to survive. Across East Africa, one person is likely dying every minute from hunger. This grotesque inequality is breaking the bonds that hold us together as humanity. It is divisive, corrosive, and dangerous. This is inequality that literally kills. The report notes that the profit margins of the world's big oil companies doubled during the pandemic, while the cost of energy worldwide is projected to soar by 50% this year, the largest increase in energy prices, the group noted, since 1973. Giant food companies that control a bulk of the world's food supply and the large pharmaceutical companies, some like Johnson & Johnson, which control large portions of the COVID-19 vaccine supply, have been swimming in profits since the virus struck. With the world's billionaire class and national leaders meeting in Davos, as they pretend to meet as stewards of international leadership, Oxfam said there is one clear thing they should do if they want to be taken seriously: support a tax on billionaire wealth. Among other things, Oxfam calls for a one-off solidarity tax on billionaires' pandemic windfalls to fund support for people facing rising food and energy costs and a fair and sustainable recovery from COVID-19. Citing the nearly $8 trillion in tax havens that the global elite is believed to have stashed around the world, the group indicated the global tax system, which has never been defensible, is no longer sustainable in the face of such enormous challenges. The group is also calling for an end to crisis profiteering by introducing a temporary excess profit tax of 90% to capture the windfall profits of big corporations across all industries. Oxfam estimates that such a tax on less than 36 super profitable multinational companies could have generated $104 billion in revenue in 2020 alone. Lastly, Oxfam says a permanent tax on extreme wealth and the disruption of monopoly power by huge multinationals is essential to equalize the world's economy, lift billions of people out of poverty, and to fund the kind of investments on healthcare, climate action, and social protection for all the low and middle income people of the world. The extremely rich and powerful are profiting from pain and suffering. This is unconscionable, said Bucha. Over 2 years since the pandemic began, after more than 20 million estimated deaths from COVID-19 and widespread economic disruption, she said government leaders in Davos face a choice: act as proxies for the billionaire class who plunder their economies, or take bold steps to act in the interest of their great majorities.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was born in Kadhimiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was.
When we look at the works of late Rawzati,
there is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamari that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. This is the teacher and analysis on the thoughts and works of the most outstanding Muslim Shia scholars, jurists, and philosophers all across the world of Islam. I'm Atar, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers for today's discussion, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyani. Sheikh Ziyani, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
For today's discussion, we want to talk about one of the most outstanding jurists and bibliographers of the Shia world. He is no one but Muhammad Mohsen ibn Ali Munzavi Tehrani, mainly known as Agha Bozorg Tehrani. And most of the Shia scholars' original name might differ from their nickname. But for today's discussion, we want to talk about Agha Bozorg Tehrani, the author of the magnum opus, Az-Zariya ila Tasanif al-Shia. Sheikh Mahdavi, let's get to you, brother. Give us some information about the early life of Sheikh Agha Bozorg Tehrani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sheikh Agha Bozorg Tehrani is born in 1293, according to lunar calendar, in one of the traditional district of Tehran named Pamenar. Mm-hmm. That is close to the actually business area or what is called as also in English as a bazaar, because his father was one of the religious businessmen at that time in Tehran. So Agha Bozorg started his scholarly life when he was 7 years old. So when he was around 15 years old, he went to Najaf in order to benefit from the scholars of Najaf. And if we want to continue chronically to talk about his lifestyle, we have to stay for a long time. He stayed in Samarra. So from Najaf, he moved to Samarra. He stayed there. He benefited from the great ulamas over there, including Muhammad Taqi Shirazi, who was known as the second Mirza Shirazi. And our listeners, they're familiar with Mirza Shirazi because of his role in the Shia history.
Okay.
So again, because of the situation of the city Samarra being surrounded by all Sunni district, he was forced to leave Samarra. So for the last part of his life, he was staying in Najaf. He benefited from the very outstanding ulama, including Mirza Hussein Nuri, Akhund Mulla Muhammad Kazim Khorasani, the author of Kifayatul Usul, and Sayyid Muhammad Kazim Tabatabai Yazdi, who is the author of Urwatul Wusqa.
That's right.
And we talked about all of these authors, alhamdulillah, in this program of The Teacher, alhamdulillah, our listeners are familiar with. So, Ayatollah Sheikh Agha Bozorg Tehrani, as you mentioned, he is considered as the great biographers as well as bibliographers of Shia.
That's right.
And also we can count two very important Shia books being authored by this great author. One is Tabaqat A'lam al-Shia, and the other is Al-Dhari'a ila Tasanif al-Shia.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Mahdawi. Let's get to Sheikh Ziya in order to have his explanation on these two outstanding books, Al-Dhari'a. Let's start with Al-Dhari'a ila Tasanif al-Shia. What is this book? And mainly Agha Bozorg Tehrani is known with this book. I mean, the author of Al-Dhari'a, Sahib Al-Dhari'a, isn't it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As you mentioned, my dear brother, Marhum late Ayatollah Agha Bozorg Tehrani is named as Sahib al-Dhari'a, and people or the scholars even may know him with this title, Sahib al-Dhari'a. That shows that this book is really a great work of him. And al-Dhari'a ila Tasanif al-Shia is a, we should say that is an encyclopedia about the books that are written by Shia scholars. And I should say at this point at the beginning of my discussion that why a scholar like Agha Bozorg Tehrani comes to this point to write such a book or to compile such a
book.
What
is the main intention?
The point is that his son is quoting that when Georgi Zeidan, a Christian scholar, says is talking about Muslim Ummah, he says that at the beginning of Muslim history or Islamic history, there are not that much Shia scholars. And we should say that maybe the beginning years of Islamic history is flourished through the books or through the activities of Sunni scholars. That's why great Allama Agha Bozorg Tehrani comes to this point, that I should compile such a book to introduce the books and also the scholars, because in Tabaqat A'lam al-Shia, he introduces the scholars of Shia. So in Al-Dhari'a, he tries to introduce the books that are written by the great scholars of Shia, and the number of 53,510 books are introduced in this book. And you know that this is not the way to say, for example, Al-Kafi is written by a Shia scholar. No. He names the book and then defines how the writer has compiled this book, defines the publications of the book, defines the time of the book in which the book is published, define the somehow the books that are related to this book, for example, the complementaries. So this is very important.
That's right.
And that's why I say that this is an encyclopedia regarding the books that are written in Shia. So, and we should notice that the book of Al-Dhari'a is written during a time that there was no computer in access.
Yes.
And I don't know how, powerful
Yes.
And enabled was the memory of late Aga Buzurg Tehrani to memorize and to, you know, collect all these, you know, and informations in his mind. That's and right. Try to analyze them and write such a book.
As I have a picture in front of my face now, my monitor, a picture of Aga Buzurg, you know, he is an old man writing on a piece of paper. Around him, so many pieces of papers and notes are over there. This is how sincere he was, you know. And it's really difficult by writing out the note, taking the notes, classifying them in an alphabetical format, you know, because they say Azariya is in alphabetical. This makes it really, really difficult by checking out different resources and the books, which were mostly in manuscripts. And we know that reading out the manuscripts needs its own special talent and power too.
Yeah.
For example, we today, in today's world, if they give us a manuscript in Persian or Arabic or even in English, reading it out, the text, the mere text, might be a difficult task.
The language is your mother tongue, but you cannot read the text.
You cannot read the text.
The handwriting itself is,
it's,
you know, very difficult.
Yeah, and you know, Aga Buzurg Tehrani did that. So this is only, Azariya is about only the references, is it? Or the scholars and the books?
The books, not the scholars.
Not the scholars, the books. But, you know, the other book is about Tabaqat A'lam al-Shia is about the authors.
Okay, regarding Tabaqat A'lam al-Shia, as we see, the title of the book is speaking to us. It's talking about the different, actually, period of time in which authors of Shia have been living in. Mm-hmm. So he's trying to employ a very nice manner for dividing his book into different chapters. So he is counting from the 4th century till 14th century, 11th century. Actually, he is saying that, okay, this 11th century is the number of the occultation, I mean the bigger occultation of Imam Asr, and based on this, I'm trying to count the Shia authors in each century, starting from the beginning up to now. Mm-hmm. So this is also was in response to the accusations.
Yes.
What my brother mentioned regarding Georgi Zeidan, it was not only limited to Georgi Zeidan. She actually, school of thought at his time, it was really attacked by different authors of having no back, having no history, having no lineage. So as it is mentioned, Azariya al-Tasanif al-Shi'ara was in favor or in charge of introducing Shia works, but this Tabaqat A'lam al-Shi'a, it's a very big 20 volumes regarding the biographies of all Shias who have been living from the 4th century till 14th century. Even he tries to include some of the Sunni authors who have this inclination about the school of thought of Ahlul Bayt and who love school of thought of Ahlul Bayt and Ahlul Bayt. He tries to include those authors also in his book. And this is one of the criticism for him, that if you call your book as Tabaqat A'lam al-Shi'a, then these minor names are included there. So it could be justified that he was trying to
give a
kind of encyclopedia of all authors, the biography of all authors who were loving Ahlul Bayt. So this is actually one of the good things in response to all accusations which are attacking Shia of not having any history, academic history.
You know, some Mustadrakat or editions, you know, were written to Azariya. The most outstanding ones were by Abdulaziz Tabatabai, Abdul Hussein Hayri, Muhammad Ali Rozati Isfahani, and Muhammad Tabatabai Behbahani. Some of the things that might be missed by Aga Buzurg Tehrani were added to this book, but according to Muhammad Tabatabai Behbahani, it was only 500 titles which were added to the book, so it shows that it was not many. And I think that Aga Buzurg Tehrani at his time did a great work and did not miss anything regarding the Shia books and the Shia scholars. Any other point missed?
Yeah.
Shaykh,
something that is very interesting regarding the writing the book Azariya is that, okay, the scholarly aspect of the book of Al-Dari'a is done by late Agha Bozorg Tehrani, but we should consider another aspect of writing this book, and that is the publication of the book. Mm-hmm. When Agha Bozorg Tehrani tries to publish this book, his uncle, that was a merchant in Tehran, he assisted Agha Bozorg Tehrani regarding the publication of the book. The uncle gave a bunch of money to Agha Bozorg Tehrani in order to sponsor him.
That's right.
And to enable him to establish a publication. And then Agha Bozorg Tehrani tries to publish his books, his great work, with the money that is gifted by his uncle.
That's
so
right.
I want to highlight this point that in Islamic history or Shia school of thought history, when we trace back the books that are written, most of the time we come to this point that great works are done by scholars, but many times we see some people that they are in shadow.
That's
and
right.
They are not famous,
yes.
But they are also the ones who assisted the scholar
right.
to publish his
okay.
book. And this is very important because whenever a person or a scholar or
yes.
anybody refers to the book Al-Dari'a,
yes.
the uncle of Agha Bozorg Tehrani also is
that's right.
taking benefit from his
yes.
studies because the uncle also is involved in publication of the book.
And they are commemorated too. And we know that the past generation of the businessman and the market man were in close relation with the religious authorities and the religious men, you know?
Yeah.
To asking their religious questions or to helping the poor. And, you know, the market was really very much different from the market that we have in today's world. So it's better to say that the patrons or the supporters and the protectors of the true legacy of the Shia world had been financially supported by the businessmen of the markets of the Islamic lands too.
And this is very important.
Yes.
When we ourselves are not able to do, you know,
yes.
scholarly activities,
yes, we can support
then
the other
we
way.
Can support the one who is doing it correctly and truly, and then we are, inshallah, have a share of thawab and rewards.
Inshallah. That's all right. Zulhijjah 13th, 1389, according to the Hijra calendar, at the age of 96, Sheikh Agha Bozorg Tehrani passed away, and according to his last will and testament, his body was taken to his own library and he was buried over there. He has a great library, we can say, which is the source of benefit for so many outstanding scholars. May Allah bless the soul of Agha Bozorg Tehrani, the author of Az-Zari'a ila Tasanif al-Shia and also Tabaqat A'lam al-Shia. May he rest in peace, inshallah. And thank you, my Sheikh Ziyaniya and Sheikh Mahdavi for your explanation regarding the life of Sheikh Agha Bozorg Tehrani. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/ and Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode introducing another Shia dignitary. God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.